was childlike, fluffy and feminine, passive, gaily content in a world of bedroom and kitchen, sex, babies, and home. The magazine surely does not leave out sex. The only passion, the only pursuit, the only goal a woman is permitted is the pursuit of a man. It is crammed full of food, clothing, cosmetics, furniture, and the physical bodies of young women. But where is the world of thought and ideas, the life of the mind and spirit? In the magazine image, women do not work except housework and work to keep their bodies beautiful and to get and keep a man. This was the image of the American woman in the year Castro led a revolution in Cuba and men were trained to travel into outer space. The year that the African continent brought forth new nations and a plane whose speed is greater than the speed of sound broke up a summit conference. The year artists picketed a great museum in protest against the hegemony of abstract art. Physicists explored the concept of antimatter. Astronomers, because of new radio telescopes, had to alter their concepts of the expanding universe. Biologists made a breakthrough in the fundamental chemistry of life. And Negro youth in Southern schools forced the United States, for the first time since the Civil War, to face a moment of democratic truth. But this magazine, published for over 5 million American women, almost all of whom have been through high school and nearly half to college, contained almost no mention of the world beyond the home. In the second half of the 20th century in America, woman's world was confined to her own body and beauty, the charming of man, the bearing of babies, and the physical care and serving of husband, children, and home. And this was no anomaly of a single issue of a single women's magazine. I sat one night at a meeting of magazine writers, mostly men, who worked for all kinds of magazines, including women's magazines. The main speaker was a leader of a desegregation battle. Before he spoke, another man outlined the needs of the large women's magazine he edited. Our readers are housewives, full-time. They're not interested in the broad public issues of the day. They are not interested in national or international affairs. They are only interested in the family and the home. They aren't interested in politics unless it's related to an immediate need in the home, like the price of coffee. Humor has to be gentle. They don't get satire. Travel, we have almost completely dropped it. Education, that's a problem. Their own education level is going up. They've generally all had a high school education and many college. They're tremendously interested in education for their children, fourth grade arithmetic. You just can't write about ideas or broad issues of the day for women. That's why we're publishing 90% service now and 10% general interest. Another editor agreed, adding plaintively, "Can't you give us something else besides there's death in your medicine cabinet? Can't any of you dream up a new crisis for women? We're always interested in sex, of course." At this point, the writers and editors spend an hour listening to Thurgood Marshall on the inside story of the desegregation battle and its possible effect on the presidential election. "Too bad I can't run that story," one editor said, "but you just can't link it to woman's world." As I listened to them, a German phrase echoed in my mind. Kinder, Kusche, Kirche. The slogan by which the Nazis decreed that women must once again be confined to their biological role. But this was not Nazi Germany. This was America. The whole world lies open to American women. Why, then, does the image deny the world? Why does it limit women to one passion, one role, one occupation? Not long ago, women dreamed and fought for equality, their own place in the world. What happened to their dreams? When did women decide to give up the world and go back home? A geologist brings up a core of mud from the bottom of the ocean and sees layers of sediment as sharp as a razor blade deposited over the years. Clues to changes in the geological evolution of the earth, so vast that they would go unnoticed during the lifespan of a single man. I sat for many days in the New York Public Library going back through bound volumes of American women's magazines for the last 20 years. I found a change in the image of the American woman and in the boundaries of the woman's world as sharp and puzzling as the changes revealed in cores of ocean sediment. In 1939, the heroines of women's magazine stories were not always young, but in a certain sense, they were younger than their fictional counterparts today. They were young in the same way that the American hero has always been young. They were new women, creating with a gay determined spirit a new identity for women, a life of their own. There was an aura about them of becoming, of moving into a future that was going to be different from the past. The majority of heroines in the four major women's magazines, then Ladies' Home Journal, McCall's, Good Housekeeping, Woman's Home Companion, were career women, happily, proudly, adventurously, attractively career women who loved and were loved by men. And the spirit, courage, independence, determination, the strength of character they showed in their work as nurses, teachers, artists, actresses, copywriters, saleswomen, were part of their charm. There was a definite aura that their individuality was something to be admired, not unattractive to men, that men were drawn to them as much for their spirit and character as for their looks. These were the mass women's magazines in their heyday. The stories were conventional. Girl meets boy or girl gets boy. But very often, this was not the major theme of the story. These heroines were usually marching towards some goal or vision of their own, struggling with some problem of work or the world when they found their man. And this new woman, less fluffily feminine, so independent and determined to find a new life of her own, was the heroine of a different kind of love story. She was less aggressive in pursuit of a man. Her passionate involvement with the world, her own sense of herself as an individual, her self-reliance, gave a different flavor to her relationship with the man. The heroine and hero of one of these stories meet and fall in love at an ad agency where they both work. "I don't want to put you in a garden behind a wall," the hero says. "I want you to walk with me hand in hand, and together we could accomplish whatever we wanted to." A Dream to Share, Red Book, January 1939. These new women were almost never housewives. In fact, the stories usually ended before they had children. They were young because the future was open, but they seemed, in another sense, much older, more mature than the childlike, kittenish young housewife heroines today. One, for example, is a nurse, mother-in-law, Ladies' Home Journal, June 1939. She was, he thought, very lovely. She hadn't an ounce of picture-book prettiness, but there was strength in her hands, pride in her carriage, and nobility in the lift of her chin, in her blue eyes. She had been on her own ever since she left training 9 years ago. She had earned her way. She need consider nothing but her heart. One heroine runs away from home when her mother insists she must make her debut instead of going on an expedition as a geologist. Her passionate determination to live her own life does not keep this new woman from loving a man, but it makes her rebel from her parents, just as the young hero often must leave home to grow up. "You've got more courage than any girl I ever saw. You have what it takes," says the boy who helps her get away. "Have a good time, dear," Ladies' Home Journal, May 1939. Often there was a conflict between some commitment to her work and the man. But the moral in 1939 was that if she kept her commitment to herself, she did not lose the man if he was the right man. A young widow, Between the Dark and the Daylight, Ladies' Home Journal, February 1939, sits in her office, debating whether to stay and correct the important mistake she has made on the job or keep her date with a man. She thinks back on her marriage, her baby, her husband's death. The time afterward, which held the struggle for clear judgment, not being afraid of new and better jobs, of having confidence in one's decisions. How can the boss expect her to give up her date? But she stays on the job. They'd put their life's blood into this campaign. She couldn't let him down. She finds her man, too, the boss. These stories may not have been great literature, but the identity of their heroines seemed to say something about the housewives who, then as now, read the women's magazines. These magazines were not written for career women. The new woman heroines were the ideal of yesterday's housewives. They reflected the dreams, mirrored the yearning identity and the sense of possibility that existed for women then. And if women could not have these dreams for themselves, they wanted their daughters to have them. They wanted their daughters to be more than housewives, to go out in the world that had been denied them. It is like remembering a long-forgotten dream to recapture the memory of what a career meant to women before career woman became a dirty word in America. Jobs meant money, of course, at the end of the Depression. But the readers of these magazines were not the women who got the jobs. Career meant more than job. It seemed to mean doing something, being somebody yourself, not just existing in and through others. I found the last clear note of the passionate search for individual identity that a career seems to have symbolized in the pre-1950 decades in a story called Sarah and the Seaplane, Ladies' Home Journal, February 1949. Sarah, who for 19 years has played the part of docile daughter, is secretly learning to fly. She misses her flying lesson to accompany her mother on a round of social calls. An elderly doctor houseguest says, "My dear Sarah, every day, all the time, you are committing suicide. It's a greater crime than not pleasing others, not doing justice to yourself." Sensing some secret, he asks if she is in love. She found it difficult to answer. In love? In love with the good-natured, the beautiful Henry, the flying teacher? In love with the flashing water and the lift of wings at the instant of freedom and the vision of the smiling, limitless world? Yes, she answered. I think I am. The next morning, Sarah solos. Henry stepped away, slamming the cabin door shut and swung the ship about for her. She was alone. There was a heady moment when everything she had learned left her, when she had to adjust herself to be alone, entirely alone, in the familiar cabin. Then she drew a deep breath, and suddenly a wonderful sense of competence made her sit erect and smiling. She was alone. She was answerable to herself alone, and she was sufficient. "I can do it," she told herself aloud. The wind flew back from the floats in glittering streaks, and then effortlessly the ship lifted itself free and soared. Even her mother can't stop her now from getting her flying license. She is not afraid of discovering my own way of life. In bed that night, she smiles sleepily, remembering how Henry had said, "You're my girl." "Henry's girl," she smiled. No, she was not Henry's girl. She was Sarah, and that was sufficient. And with such a late start, it would be some time before she got to know herself. Half in a dream now, she wondered if at the end of that time she would need someone else, and who it would be. And then suddenly the image blurs. The new woman, soaring free, hesitates in mid-flight, shivers in all that blue sunlight, and rushes back to the cozy walls of home. In the same year that Sarah soloed, the Ladies' Home Journal printed the prototype of the innumerable paeans to occupation housewife that started to appear in the women's magazines, paeans that resounded throughout the 50s. They usually began with a woman complaining that when she has to write housewife on the census blank, she gets an inferiority complex. "When I write it, I realize that here I am, a middle-aged woman with a university education, and I've never made anything out of my life. I'm just a housewife." Then the author of the paean, who somehow never is a housewife, in this case Dorothy Thompson, newspaper woman, foreign correspondent, famous columnist in Ladies' Home Journal, March 1949, roars with laughter. "The trouble with you," she scolds, "is you don't realize you are expert in a dozen careers simultaneously. You might write business manager, cook, nurse, chauffeur, dressmaker, interior decorator, accountant, caterer, teacher, private secretary, or just put down philanthropist. All your life you have been giving away your energies, your skills, your talents, your services, for love. But still, the housewife complains, I'm nearly 50 and I've never done what I hoped to do in my youth, music. I've wasted my college education." "Ho, ho," laughs Miss Thompson. "Aren't your children musical because of you? And all those struggling years while your husband was finishing his great work, didn't you keep a charming home on $3,000 a year and make all your children's clothes in your own and paper the living room yourself and watch the markets like a hawk for bargains? And in time off, didn't you type and proofread your husband's manuscripts, plan festivals to make up the church deficit, play piano duets with the children to make practicing more fun, read their books in high school to follow their study? But all this vicarious living, through others, the housewife sighs, as vicarious as Napoleon Bonaparte, Miss Thompson scoffs, or a queen. I simply refuse to share your self-pity. You are one of the most successful women I know. As for not earning any money, the argument goes, let the housewife compute the cost of her services. Women can save more money by their managerial talents inside the home than they can bring into it by outside work. As for a woman's spirit being broken by the boredom of household tasks, maybe the genius of some women has been thwarted, but a world full of feminine genius but poor in children would come rapidly to an end. Great men have great mothers. And the American housewife is reminded that Catholic countries in the Middle Ages elevated the gentle and inconspicuous Mary into the Queen of Heaven and built their loveliest cathedrals to Notre Dame, Our Lady. The homemaker, the nurturer, the creator of children's environment is the constant recreator of culture, civilization, and virtue. Assuming that she is doing well that great managerial task and creative activity, let her write her occupation proudly. Housewife. In 1949, the Ladies' Home Journal also ran Margaret Mead's Male and Female. All the magazines were echoing Farnham and Lundberg's Modern Woman, The Lost Sex, which came out in 1942 with its warnings that careers in higher education were leading to the masculinization of women with enormously dangerous consequences to the home, the children dependent on it, and to the ability of the woman, as well as her husband, to obtain sexual gratification. And so the feminine mystique began to spread through the land, grafted onto old prejudices and comfortable conventions which so easily give the past a stranglehold on the future. Behind the new mystique were concepts and theories deceptive in their sophistication and their assumption of accepted truth. These theories were supposedly so complex that they were inaccessible to all but a few initiates and therefore irrefutable. It will be necessary to break through this wall of mystery and look more closely at these complex concepts, these accepted truths, to understand fully what has happened to American women. The feminine mystique says that the highest value and the only commitment for women is the fulfillment of their own femininity. It says that the great mistake of Western culture, through most of its history, has been the undervaluation of this femininity. It says this femininity is so mysterious and intuitive and close to the creation and origin of life that man-made science may never be able to understand it. But however special and different, it is in no way inferior to the nature of man. It may even, in certain respects, be superior. The mistake, says the mystique, the root of women's troubles in the past is that women envied men, women tried to be like men, instead of accepting their own nature, which can find fulfillment only in sexual passivity, male domination, and nurturing maternal love. But the new image this mystique gives to American women is the old image, occupation housewife. The new mystique makes the housewife mothers, who never had a chance to be anything else, the model for all women. It presupposes that history has reached a final and glorious end in the here and now, as far as women are concerned. Beneath the sophisticated trappings, it simply makes certain concrete, finite, domestic aspects of feminine existence, as it was lived by women whose lives were confined by necessity to cooking, cleaning, washing, bearing children, into a religion, a pattern by which all women must now live or deny their femininity. Fulfillment as a woman had only one definition for American women after 1949, the housewife mother. As swiftly as in a dream, the image of the American woman as a changing, growing individual in a changing world was shattered. Her solo flight to find her own identity was forgotten in the rush for the security of togetherness. Her limitless world shrunk to the cozy walls of home. The transformation, reflected in the pages of the women's magazines, was sharply visible in 1949 and progressive through the 50s. Femininity begins at home. It's a man's world, maybe. Having babies while you're young. How to snare a male. Should I stop work when we marry? Are you training your daughter to be a wife? Careers at home. Do women have to talk so much? Why GIs prefer those German girls? What women can learn from Mother Eve? Really a man's world, politics. How to hold on to a happy marriage. Don't be afraid to marry young. The doctor talks about breastfeeding. Our baby was born at home. Cooking to me is poetry. The business of running a home. By the end of 1949, only one out of three heroines in the women's magazines was a career woman. And she was shown in the act of renouncing her career and discovering that what she really wanted to be was a housewife. In 1958, and again in 1959, I went through issue after issue of the three major women's magazines. The fourth, Woman's Home Companion, had died. Without finding a single heroine who had a career, a commitment to any work, art, profession, or mission in the world other than occupation, housewife. Only 1 in 100 heroines had a job. Even the young unmarried heroines no longer worked except at snaring a husband. These new happy housewife heroines seemed strangely younger than the spirited career girls of the 30s and 40s. They seemed to get younger all the time, in looks and a childlike kind of dependence. They have no vision of the future except to have a baby. The only active growing figure in their world is the child. The housewife heroines are forever young because their own image ends in childbirth. Like Peter Pan, they must remain young while their children grow up in the world. They must keep on having babies because the feminine mystique says there is no other way for a woman to be a heroine. Here's a typical specimen from a story called The Sandwich Maker, Ladies' Home Journal, April 1959. She took home economics in college, learned how to cook, never held a job, and still plays the child bride, though she now has three children of her own. Her problem is money. Oh, nothing boring like taxes or reciprocal trade agreements or foreign aid programs. I leave all that economic jazz to my constitutionally elected representative in Washington, heaven help him. The problem is her $42.10 allowance. She hates having to ask her husband for money every time she needs a pair of shoes, but he won't trust her with a charge account. Oh, how I yearned for a little money of my own. Not much, really. A few hundred a year would have done it. Just enough to meet a friend for lunch occasionally, to indulge in extravagantly colored stockings, a few small items without having to appeal to Charlie. But alas, Charlie was right. I'd never earned a dollar in my life and had no idea of how money was made. So all I did for a long time was brood, as I continued with my cooking, cleaning, cooking, washing, ironing, cooking. At last the solution comes. She will take orders for sandwiches from other men at her husband's plant. She earns $52.50 a week, except that she forgets to count costs, and she doesn't remember what a gross is, so she has to hide 8,640 sandwich bags behind the furnace. Charlie says she's making the sandwiches too fancy. She explains, if it's only ham on rye, then I'm just a sandwich maker, and I'm not interested, but the extras, the special touches, well, they make it sort of creative. So she chops, wraps, peels, seals, spreads bread, starting at dawn and never finished, for $9 net until she is disgusted by the smell of food and finally staggers downstairs after a sleepless night to slice a salami for the 8 gaping lunchboxes. It was too much. Charlie came down just then and after one quick look at me, ran for a glass of water. She realizes that she is going to have another baby. Charlie's first coherent words were, I'll cancel your lunch orders. You're a mother. That's your job. You don't have to earn money, too. It was also beautifully simple. Yes, boss, I murmured, obediently, frankly relieved. That night he brings her home a checkbook. He will trust her with a joint account. So she decides just to keep quiet about the 8,640 sandwich bags. Anyhow, she'll have used them up, making sandwiches for four children to take to school by the time the youngest is ready for college. The road from Sarah and the seaplane to the sandwich maker was traveled in only 10 years. In those 10 years, the image of American woman seems to have suffered a schizophrenic split. and the split in the image goes much further than the savage obliteration of career from women's dreams. In an earlier time, the image of woman was also split in two, the good, pure woman on the pedestal and the whore of the desires of the flesh. The split in the new image opens a different fissure, the feminine woman, whose goodness includes the desires of the flesh, and the career woman, whose evil includes every desire of the separate self. The new feminine morality story is the exorcising of the forbidden career dream, the heroine's victory over Mephistopheles, the devil, first in the form of a career woman who threatens to take away the heroine's husband or child, and finally, the devil inside the heroine herself, the dream of independence, the discontent of spirit, and even the feeling of a separate identity that must be exorcised to win or keep the love of husband and child. In a story in Red Book, A Man Who Acted Like a Husband, November 1957, the child bride heroine, a little freckled-faced brunette whose nickname is Junior, is visited by her old college roommate. The roommate, Kay, is a man's girl, really, with a good head for business. She wore her polished mahogany hair in a high chignon speared with two chopstick affairs. Kay is not only divorced, but she has also left her child with his grandmother while she works in television. This career woman devil tempts Junior with the lure of a job to keep her from breastfeeding her baby. She even restrains the young mother from going to her baby when he cries at 2 a.m. But she gets her comeuppance when George, the husband, discovers the crying baby uncovered in a freezing wind from an open window with blood running down its cheek. Kay, reformed and repentant, plays hooky from her job to go get her own child and start life anew. And Junior, gloating at the 2 a.m. feeding, "I'm glad, glad, glad I'm just a housewife," starts to dream about the baby, growing up to be a housewife too. With the career woman out of the way, the housewife with interests in the community becomes the devil to be exorcised. Even PTA takes on a suspect connotation, not to mention interest in some international cause. See Almost a Love Affair, McCall's November 1955. The housewife who simply has a mind of her own is the next to go. The heroine of I Didn't Want to Tell You, McCall's January 1958, is shown balancing the checkbook by herself and arguing with her husband about a small domestic detail. It develops that she is losing her husband to a helpless little widow whose main appeal is that she can't think straight about an insurance policy or mortgage. The betrayed wife says, "She must have sex appeal, and what weapon has a wife against that?" But her best friend tells her, "You're making this too simple. You're forgetting how helpless Tanya can be and how grateful to the man who helps her." "I couldn't be a clinging vine if I tried," the wife says. "I had a better-than-average job after I left college, and I was always a pretty independent person. I'm not a helpless little woman, and I can't pretend to be." But she learns that night. She hears a noise that might be a burglar. Even though she knows it's only a mouse, she calls helplessly to her husband and wins him back. As he comforts her pretended panic, she murmurs that, of course, he was right in their argument that morning. She lay still in the soft bed, smiling in sweet, secret satisfaction, scarcely touched with guilt. The end of the road, in an almost literal sense, is the disappearance of the heroine altogether, as a separate self and the subject of her own story. The end of the road is togetherness, where the woman has no independent self to hide, even in guilt. She exists only for and through her husband and children. Coined by the publishers of McCall's in 1954, the concept, togetherness, was seized upon avidly as a movement of spiritual significance by advertisers, ministers, newspaper editors. For a time, it was elevated into virtually a national purpose. But very quickly, there was a sharp social criticism and bitter jokes about togetherness as a substitute for larger human goals, for men. Women were taken to task for making their husbands do housework instead of letting them pioneer in the nation and the world. Why, it was asked, should men with the capacities of statesmen, anthropologists, physicists, poets, have to wash dishes and diaper babies on weekday evenings or Saturday mornings when they might use those extra hours to fulfill larger commitments to their society? Significantly, critics resented only that men were being asked to share woman's world. Few questioned the boundaries of this world for women. No one seemed to remember that women were once thought to have the capacity and vision of statesmen, poets, and physicists. Few saw the big lie of togetherness for women. Consider the Easter 1954 issue of McCall's, which announced the new era of togetherness, sounding the requiem for the days when women fought for and won political equality, and the women's magazines helped you to carve out large areas of living formerly forbidden to your sex. The new way of life in which men and women in ever-increasing numbers are marrying at an earlier age, having children at an earlier age, rearing larger families, and gaining their deepest satisfaction from their own homes is one which men, women, and children are achieving together, not as women alone or men alone, isolated from one another, but as a family sharing a common experience. The picture essay detailing that way of life is called A Man's Place is in the Home. It describes, as a new image and ideal, a New Jersey couple with three children in a gray shingle split-level house. Ed and Carol have centered their lives almost completely around their children and their home. They are shown shopping at the supermarket, carpentering, dressing the children, making breakfast together. Then Ed joins the members of his carpool and heads for the office. Ed, the husband, chooses the color scheme for the house and makes the major decorating decisions. The chores Ed likes are listed: putter around the house, make things, paint, select furniture, rugs and draperies, dry dishes, read to the children and put them to bed, work in the garden, feed and dress and bathe the children, attend PTA meetings, cook, buy clothes for his wife, buy groceries. Ed doesn't like these chores: dusting, vacuuming, finishing jobs he started, hanging draperies, washing pots and pans and dishes, picking up after the children, shoveling snow or mowing the lawn, changing diapers, taking the babysitter home, doing the laundry, ironing. Ed, of course, does not do these chores. For the sake of every member of the family needs a head. This means father, not mother. Children of both sexes need to learn, recognize, and respect the abilities and functions of each sex. He is not just a substitute mother, even though he's ready and willing to do his share of bathing, feeding, comforting, playing. He is a link with the outside world he works in. If in that world he is interested, courageous, tolerant, constructive, he will pass on these values to his children. There were many agonized editorial sessions in those days at McCall's. Suddenly, everybody was looking for the spiritual significance in togetherness, expecting us to make some mysterious religious movement out of the life everyone had been leading for the last 5 years, crawling into the home, turning their backs on the world. But we can never find a way of showing it that wasn't a monstrosity of dullness, a former McCall's editor reminisces. It always boiled down to, goody, 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 daddy's out there in the garden barbecuing. We put men in the fashion pictures and the food pictures and even the perfume pictures, but we were stifled by it editorially. We had articles by psychiatrists that we couldn't use because they would have blown it wide open, all those couples propping their whole weight on their kids. But what else could you do with togetherness but childcare? We were pathetically grateful to find anything else where we could show father photographed with mother. Sometimes we used to wonder what would happen to women with men taking over the decorating, childcare, cooking, all the things that used to be hers alone. But we couldn't show women getting out of the home and having a career. The irony is, what we meant to do was to stop editing for women as women and edit for the men and women together. We wanted to edit for people, not women. But forbidden to join man in the world, can women be people? Forbidden independence, they finally are swallowed in an image of such passive dependence that they want men to make the decisions, even in the home. The frantic illusion that togetherness can impart a spiritual content to the dullness of domestic routine, the need for a religious movement to make up for the lack of identity, betrays the measure of women's loss and the emptiness of the image. Could making men share the housework compensate women for their loss of the world? Could vacuuming the living room floor together give the housewife some mysterious new purpose in life? In 1956, at the peak of togetherness, the board editors of McCall's ran a little article called The Mother Who Ran Away. To their amazement, it brought the highest readership of any article they had ever run. "It was our moment of truth," said a former editor. "We suddenly realized that all those women at home with their 3.5 children were miserably unhappy." But by then, the new image of American woman, occupation housewife, had hardened into a mystique, unquestioned and permitting no questions, shaping the very reality it distorted. By the time I started writing for women's magazines in the 50s, it was simply taken for granted by editors and accepted as an immutable fact of life by writers that women were not interested in politics, life outside the United States, national issues, art, science, ideas, adventure, education, or even their own communities, except where they could be sold through their emotions as wives and mothers. Politics for women became Mamie's clothes and then Nixon's home life. Out of conscience, a sense of duty, the Ladies' Home Journal might run a series like Political Pilgrim's Progress, showing women trying to improve their children's schools and playgrounds. But even approaching politics through mother love did not really interest women, it was thought in the trade. Everyone knew those readership percentages. An editor of Red Book ingeniously tried to bring the bomb down to the feminine level by showing the emotions of a wife whose husband sailed into a contaminated area. "Women can't take an idea, an issue, pure," men who edited the mass women's magazines agreed. "It has to be translated in terms they can understand as women." This was so well understood by those who wrote for women's magazines that a natural childbirth expert submitted an article to a leading women's magazine called How to Have a Baby in an Atom Bomb Shelter. "The article was not well written," an editor told me, "or we might have bought it." According to the mystique, women and their mysterious femininity might be interested in the concrete biological details of having a baby in a bomb shelter, but never in the abstract idea of the bomb's power to destroy the human race. Such a belief, of course, becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. In 1960, a perceptive social psychologist showed me some sad statistics which seemed to prove unmistakably that American women under 35 are not interested in politics. "They may have the vote, but they don't dream about running for office," he told me. "If you write a political piece, they won't read it. You have to translate it into issues they can understand. Romance, pregnancy, nursing, home furnishings, clothes. Run an article on the economy or the race question, civil rights, and you'd think that women had never heard of them." Maybe they hadn't heard of them. Ideas are not like instincts of the blood that spring into the mind intact. They are communicated by education, by the printed word. The new young housewives who leave high school or college to marry do not read books, the psychological surveys say. They only read magazines. Magazines today assume women are not interested in ideas. But going back to the bound volumes in the library, I found in the 30s and 40s that the mass circulation magazines, like Ladies' Home Journal, carried hundreds of articles about the world outside the home. The first inside story of American diplomatic relations preceding declared war. "Can the U.S. have peace after this war?" by Walter Lippmann. "Stalin at Midnight" by Harold Stassen. "General Stilwell reports on China." Articles about the last days of Czechoslovakia by Vincent Sheehan. "The persecution of Jews in Germany." "The New Deal." Carl Sandburg's account of Lincoln's assassination. Faulkner's stories of Mississippi. And Margaret Sanger's battle for birth control. In the 1950s, they printed virtually no articles except those that serviced women as housewives or described women as housewives or permitted a purely feminine identification like the Duchess of Windsor or Princess Margaret. If we get an article about a woman who does anything adventurous out of the way, something by herself, you know, we figure she must be terribly aggressive, neurotic, a Ladies' Home Journal editor told me. Margaret Sanger would never get in today. In 1960, I saw statistics that showed that women under 35 could not identify with the spirited heroine of a story who worked in an ad agency and persuaded the boy to stay and fight for his principles in the big city instead of running home to the security of a family business. Nor could these new young housewives identify with the young minister acting on his belief in defiance of convention. But they had no trouble at all identifying with the young man paralyzed at 18. I regained consciousness to discover that I could not move or even speak. I could wiggle only one finger of one hand. With help from Faith and a psychiatrist, I am now finding reasons to live as fully as possible. Does it say something about the new housewife readers that, as any editor can testify, they can identify completely with the victims of blindness, deafness, physical maiming, cerebral palsy, paralysis, cancer, or approaching death? Such articles about people who cannot see or speak or move have been an enduring staple of the women's magazines in the era of Occupation Housewife. They are told with infinitely realistic detail over and over again, replacing the articles about the nation, the world, ideas, issues, art, and science, replacing the stories about adventurous, spirited women. And whether the victim is man, woman, or child, whether the living death is incurable cancer or creeping paralysis, the housewife reader can identify. Writing for these magazines, I was continually reminded by editors that women have to identify. Once I wanted to write an article about an artist, so I wrote about her cooking and marketing and falling in love with her husband and painting a crib for her baby. I had to leave out the hours she spent painting pictures, her serious work, and the way she felt about it. You could sometimes get away with writing about a woman who was not really a housewife if you made her sound like a housewife, if you left out her commitment to the world outside the home or the private vision of mind or spirit that she pursued. In February 1949, the Ladies' Home Journal ran a feature, Poet's Kitchen, showing Edna St. Vincent Millay cooking. Now I expect to hear no more about houseworks being beneath anyone, for if one of the greatest poets of our day, and any day, can find beauty in simple household tasks, this is the end of the old controversy. The one career woman who was always welcome in the pages of the women's magazines was the actress. But her image also underwent a remarkable change. From a complex individual of fiery temper, inner depth, and a mysterious blend of spirit and sexuality, to a sexual object, a baby-faced bride, or a housewife. Think of Greta Garbo, for instance, and Marlene Dietrich, Betty Davis, Rosalind Russell, Katharine Hepburn. Then think of Marilyn Monroe, Debbie Reynolds, Brigitte Bardot, and I Love Lucy. When you wrote about an actress for a women's magazine, you wrote about her as a housewife. You never showed her doing or enjoying her work as an actress unless she eventually paid for it by losing her husband or her child, or otherwise admitting failure as a woman. A Redbook profile of Judy Holliday, June 1957, described how a brilliant woman begins to find in her work the joy she never found in life. On the screen, we are told she plays with warmth and conviction, the part of a mature, intelligent wife and expectant mother, a role unlike anything she had previously attempted. She must find fulfillment in her career because she is divorced from her husband, has strong feelings of inadequacy as a woman. It is a frustrating irony of Judy's life that, as an actress, she has succeeded almost without trying, although, as a woman, she has failed. Strangely enough, as the feminine mystique spread, denying women careers or any commitment outside the home, the proportion of American women working outside the home increased to 1 out of 3. True, 2 out of 3 were still housewives, but why, at the moment when the doors of the world were finally open to all women, should the mystique deny the very dreams that had stirred women for a century? I found a clue one morning, sitting in the office of a women's magazine editor, a woman who, older than I, remembers the days when the old image was being created and who had watched it being displaced. The old image of the spirited career girl was largely created by writers and editors who were women, she told me. The new image of woman as housewife mother has been largely created by writers and editors who are men. Most of the material used to come from women writers, she said almost nostalgically. As the young men returned from the war, a great many women writers dropped out of the field. The young women started having a lot of children and stopped writing. The new writers were all men, back from the war, who had been dreaming about home and a cozy domestic life. One by one, the creators of the gay career girl heroines of the 30s began to retire. By the end of the 40s, the writers who couldn't get the knack of writing in the new housewife image had left the women's magazine field. The new magazine pros were men, and a few women who could write comfortably according to the housewife formula. Other people began to assemble backstage at the women's magazines. There was a new kind of woman writer who lived in the housewife image, or pretended to, and there was a new kind of woman's editor or publisher, less interested in ideas to reach women's minds and hearts than in selling them the things that interest advertisers: appliances, detergents, lipstick. Today, the deciding voice on most of these magazines is cast by men. Women often carry out the formulas, women edit the housewife service departments, but the formulas themselves, which have dictated the new housewife image, are the product of men's minds. Also during the 40s and 50s, serious fiction writers of either sex disappeared from the mass circulation women's magazines. In fact, fiction of any quality was almost completely replaced by a different kind of article. No longer the old article about issues or ideas, but the new service feature. Sometimes these articles lavish the artistry of a poet and the honesty of a crusading reporter on baking chiffon pies or buying washing machines or the miracles paint can do for a living room or diets, drugs, clothes, and cosmetics to make the body into a vision of physical beauty. Sometimes they dealt with very sophisticated ideas. New developments in psychiatry, child psychology, sex and marriage, medicine. It was assumed that women readers could take these ideas, which appealed to their needs as wives and mothers, but only if they were boiled down to concrete physical details, spelled out in terms of the daily life of an average housewife with concrete do's and don'ts. How to keep your husband happy, how to solve your child's bedwetting, how to keep death out of your medicine cabinet. But here's a curious thing. Within the narrow range, these women's magazine articles, whether straight service to the housewife or a documentary report about the housewife, were almost always superior in quality to women's magazine fiction. They were better written, more honest, more sophisticated. This observation was made over and over again by intelligent readers and puzzled editors and by writers themselves. The serious fiction writers have become too internal. They're inaccessible to our readers, so we're left with the formula writers, an editor of Red Book said. And yet, in the old days, serious writers like Nancy Hale, even William Faulkner, wrote for the women's magazines and were not considered inaccessible. Perhaps the new image of woman did not permit the internal honesty, the depth of perception, and the human truth essential to good fiction. At the very least, fiction requires a hero, or, understandably, for women's magazines, a heroine who is an I in pursuit of some human goal or dream. There is a limit to the number of stories that can be written about a girl in pursuit of a boy, or a housewife in pursuit of a ball of dust under the sofa. Thus the service article takes over, replacing the internal honesty and truth needed in fiction with a richness of honest, objective, concrete, realistic, domestic detail. The color of walls or lipstick, the exact temperature of the oven. Judging from the women's magazines today, it would seem that the concrete details of women's lives are more interesting than their thoughts, their ideas, their dreams. Or does the richness and realism of the detail, the careful description of small events, mask the lack of dreams, the vacuum of ideas, the terrible boredom that has settled over the American housewife? I sat in the office of another old-timer, one of the few women editors left in the women's magazine world, now so largely dominated by men. She explained her share in creating the feminine mystique. "Many of us were psychoanalyzed," she recalled, "and we began to feel embarrassed about being career women ourselves. There was this terrible fear that we were losing our femininity. We kept looking for ways to help women accept their feminine role." If the real women editors were not somehow able to give up their own careers, all the more reason to help other women fulfill themselves as wives and mothers. The few women who still sit in editorial conferences do not bow to the feminine mystique in their own lives. But such is the power of the image they have helped create that many of them feel guilty. And if they have missed out somewhere on love or children, they wonder if their careers were to blame. Behind her cluttered desk, a Mademoiselle editor said uneasily, "The girls we bring in now as college guest editors seem almost to pity us. Because we are career women, I suppose." At a luncheon session with the last bunch, we asked them to go around the table, telling us their own career plans. Not one of the 20 raised her hand. "When I remember how I worked to learn this job and loved it, were we all crazy then?" Coupled with the women editors who sold themselves their own bill of goods, a new breed of women writers began to write about themselves as if they were just housewives, reveling in a comic world of children's pranks and eccentric washing machines and parents' night at the PTA. After making the bed of a 12-year-old boy week after week, climbing Mount Everest would seem a laughable anticlimax, writes Shirley Jackson, McCall's April 1956. When Shirley Jackson, who all her adult life has been an extremely capable writer, pursuing a craft far more demanding than bedmaking, and Jean Kerr, who is a playwright, and Phyllis McGinley, who is a poet, picture themselves as housewives, they may or may not overlook the housekeeper or maid who really makes the beds. But they implicitly deny the vision and the satisfying hard work involved in their stories, poems, and plays. They deny the lives they lead, not as housewives, but as individuals. They are good craftsmen, the best of these housewife writers, and some of their work is funny. The things that happen with children, a 12-year-old boy's first cigarette, the Little League, and the kindergarten rhythm band are often funny. They happen in real life to women who are writers, as well as women who are just housewives. But there is something about housewife writers that isn't funny, like Uncle Tom or Amos and Andy. Laugh, the housewife writers tell the Real Housewife, if you are feeling desperate, empty, bored, trapped in the bedmaking, chauffeuring, and dishwashing details. Isn't it funny? We're all in the same trap. Do real housewives then dissipate in laughter their dreams and their sense of desperation? Do they think their frustrated abilities and their limited lives are a joke? Shirley Jackson makes the beds, loves and laughs at her son, and writes another book. Jean Kerr's plays are produced on Broadway. The joke is not on them. Some of the new housewife writers live the image. Red Book tells us that the author of an article on breastfeeding, a woman named Betty Ann Countrywoman, had planned to be a doctor, but just before her graduation from Radcliffe cum laude, she shrank from the thought that such a dedication might shut her off from what she really wanted, which was to marry and have a large family. She enrolled in the Yale University School of Nursing and then became engaged to a young psychiatrist on their first date. Now they have 6 children, ranging in age from 2 to 13, and Mrs. Countrywoman is instructor in breastfeeding at the Maternity League of Indianapolis. Red Book, June 1960. She says, "For the mother, breastfeeding becomes a complement to the act of creation. It gives her a heightened sense of fulfillment and allows her to participate in a relationship as close to perfection as any that a woman can hope to achieve. The simple fact of giving birth, however, does not of itself fulfill this need and longing. Motherliness is a way of life. It enables a woman to express her total self with the tender feelings, the protective attitudes, the encompassing love of the motherly woman." When motherhood, a fulfillment held sacred down the ages, is defined as a total way of life, must women themselves deny the world and the future open to them, or does the denial of that world force them to make motherhood a total way of life? The line between mystique and reality dissolves. Real women embody the split in the image. In the spectacular Christmas 1956 issue of Life, devoted in full to the new American woman, we see, not as women's magazine villain, but as documentary fact, the typical career woman, that fatal error that feminism propagated, seeking help from a psychiatrist. She is bright, well-educated, ambitious, attractive. She makes about the same money as her husband, but she is pictured here as frustrated, so masculinized by her career that her castrated, impotent, passive husband is indifferent to her sexually. He refuses to take responsibility and drowns his destroyed masculinity in alcoholism. Then there is the discontented suburban wife who raises hell at the PTA. Morbidly depressed, she destroys her children and dominates her husband, whom she envies for going out into the business world. The wife, having worked before marriage, or at least having been educated for some kind of intellectual work, finds herself in the lamentable position of being just a housewife. In her disgruntlement, she can work as much damage on the lives of her husband and children and her own life as if she were a career woman, and indeed, sometimes more. And finally, in bright and smiling contrast, are the new housewife mothers who cherish their differentness, their unique femininity, the receptivity and passivity implicit in their sexual nature. Devoted to their own beauty and their ability to bear and nurture children, they are feminine women with truly feminine attitudes, admired by men for their miraculous, God-given, sensationally unique ability to wear skirts with all the implications of that fact. Rejoicing in the reappearance of the old-fashioned 3-to-5-child family in an astonishing quarter, the upper and upper-middle-class suburbs, life says. Here, among women who might be best qualified for careers, there is an increasing emphasis on the nurturing and homemaking values. One might guess that because these women are better informed and more mature than the average, they have been the first to comprehend the penalties of feminism and to react against them. Styles in ideas, as well as in dress and decoration, tend to seep down from such places to the broader population. This is the counter trend, which may eventually demolish the dominant and disruptive trend and make marriage what it should be, a true partnership in which men are men, women are women, and both are quietly, pleasantly, securely confident of which they are, and absolutely delighted to find themselves married to someone of the opposite sex. Look glowed at about the same time, October 16th, 1956. The American woman is winning the battle of the sexes. Like a teenager, she is growing up and confounding her critics. No longer a psychological immigrant to man's world, she works, rather casually, as a third of the U.S. labor force, less towards a big career than as a way of filling a hope chest or buying a new home freezer. She gracefully concedes the top jobs to men. This wondrous creature also marries younger than ever, bears more babies, and looks and acts far more feminine than the emancipated girl of the 1920s or even 30s. Steelworker's wife and junior leaguer alike do their own housework. Today, if she makes an old-fashioned choice and lovingly tends a garden and a bumper crop of children, she rates louder hosannas than ever before. In the new America, fact is more important than fiction. The documentary life and look images of real women who devote their lives to children and home are played back as the ideal, the way women should be. This is powerful stuff, not to be shrugged off like the heroines of women's magazine fiction. When a mystique is strong, it makes its own fiction a fact. It feeds on the very facts which might contradict it, and seeps into every corner of the culture, bemusing even the social critics. Adlai Stevenson, in a commencement address at Smith College in 1955, reprinted in Woman's Home Companion, September 1955, dismissed the desire of educated women to play their own political part in the crisis of the age. Modern woman's participation in politics is through her role as wife and mother, said the spokesman of democratic liberalism. Women, especially educated women, have a unique opportunity to influence us, man and boy. The only problem is woman's failure to appreciate that her true part in the political crisis is as wife and mother. Once immersed in the very pressing and particular problems of domesticity, many women feel frustrated and far apart from the great issues and stirring debate for which their education has given them understanding and relish. Once they wrote poetry, now it's the laundry list. Once they discussed art and philosophy until late in the night, now they are so tired they fall asleep as soon as the dishes are finished. There is often a sense of contraction, of closing horizons and lost opportunities. They had hoped to play their part in the crisis of the age, but what they do is wash the diapers. The point is that whether we talk of Africa, Islam, or Asia, women never had it so good as you. In short, far from the vocation of marriage and motherhood, leading you away from the great issues of our day, it brings you back to their very center and places upon you an infinitely deeper and more intimate responsibility than that borne by the majority of those who hit the headlines and make the news and live in such a turmoil of great issues that they end by being totally unable to distinguish which issues are really great. Women's political job is to inspire in her home a vision of the meaning of life and freedom, to help her husband find values that will give purpose to his specialized daily chores, to teach her children the uniqueness of each individual human being. This assignment for you as wives and mothers, you can do in the living room with a baby in your lap or in the kitchen with a can opener in your hand. If you're clever, maybe you can even practice your saving arts on that